Working Cows Podcast, episode 98.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi everybody, this is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, here with another episode for you all. I am recording today from the Old Crow Corner in Killdeer, North Dakota, and they happen to be a great little coffee shop right here on Highway 22 in Killdeer, North Dakota, with free Wi-Fi, good coffee, good tea, good bagels, good cream cheese. So good place to stop and spend the day if you got some time, and would highly recommend it. Thanks so much to the Old Crow Corner on Highway 22 in Killdeer, North Dakota. And so they're maybe not as acoustically excellent as we would normally get in an office that is cluttered by books and couches and different things like that, but it is perfect because it was available and it was a place where I could sit down and talk with Bob Havard. And Bob is a regenerative agriculturalist from the Midlands of the UK, and I thought it would be a very interesting conversation just to expose you guys to the differences and similarities of ranching in the Midlands of the UK. And Bob is also a speaker and has hosted many open days, as we'll talk about, at his ranch. So really appreciate Bob taking the time to join me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you reaching out and letting me know that you were listening there from the Midlands of the UK. And I know I've heard other people in the UK talk about how vast America is as a country. And so I think that I would like to give you an opportunity to share a little bit about the typical ranching operation as you understand it there in the UK and in England and some of those things.
Yeah, it's a really quite a varied picture. I think there's, I grew up on a 170-acre farm here, and that would have been considered a small farm. Now, we're up to about 450 acres now, and that's now considered a small farm. But it does vary. You get some of the more long-term landowners, some of the old old families that have been on the land a long time can be a few thousand acres. I did a grazing day for an estate up in Scotland last year, which was a 10,000 acre estate. So it does vary, but that would be right on the top scale, the 10,000 acre estate of what we have over here. Obviously, you know, I think we'd fit, you know, the whole of Britain into one of your states, so that gives an idea of scale for us.
Right. And what is the typical stocking rate? Do you guys have a wide variety there as far as more wet areas and more dry areas, or is it pretty uniform?
I think we're lucky that, the east of the country would have less rainfall. So west of the country and West Wales could be up to 70 plus inches of rain a year, spread throughout the year. They can grow a lot of grass there. They also have the challenge of managing the mud and the pastures in the winter. I think on the whole, though, you know, we're lucky to get moisture when we need it most years. My uncle always used to say, you know, when everyone was complaining about the weather, he just always used to just say, there's always a harvest here. There's always a harvest here. So.
I like that. There's always a harvest here. That's good. What would you say are some of the major differences between ranching there in the UK and ranching in America?
I think probably one of the key differences over here is that we house, as a standard operation, all our cattle on our operation are outside all year. But I think on the whole, most people house their cattle in barns over winter, and in the wetter places, the standard operation is to be in 6-7 months of the year sometimes. And nature of the weather and keeping animals off the pasture. Quite high stocking rates. So because we get the rain, we can manage to grow a lot of grass. So we'll conserve a lot of forage, a lot of silage. And then with maize, you know, people would be aiming, you know, with the maize and the forage crops and everything, they'd be looking to try and get a cow to the acre or better on the best land. So.
Sure. And do they, in they measure it in acres there in the UK? Is that?
Yeah, I think the Europeans would like us to use hectares probably, but yeah, I think most people still use acres over here. I'm probably a bit old fashioned in that regard, but I have to also have conversations with my father, so it stays in acres.
Gotcha. And what are you doing, what are most people doing for that 6 or 7 months of the year that they're locked up? You mentioned corn and silage. What are some of the other ways they're managing that?
It varies. I guess in the organic sector, it's there's a requirement of 70% forage in the diet. In the conventional sector, it does vary between a forage, mainly forage diet, but on the whole, you know, the standard industry operation would be good grass silage fed through the winter, possibly with a TMR, total mixed ration, of maize and grain and other things in there for the high performance cattle, high growth rates. But I think we're at a place now in the industry where the margins on that high input system are just not really there unless you're really in the top 5-10% in terms of scale. And, you know, I guess you could say, I reckon probably every 10 or 15 years, bottom third drops out of the industry, farms get bigger, and that's the direction of travel. I think the only thing is that regenerative agriculture or, you know, a lot of the mob grazing, holistic grazing stuff that started to take off over here is perhaps changing that a little bit, because people are looking for ways to stay in business, to be frank.
What would you say when you say top 5 or 10%? Can you give us a sense of the scale of those operations that are using a TMR and some of those other things and doing it in a way that they can do it in a large enough scale that they are profitable or sustainable, or, you know, we can argue about what those terms mean and how sustainable those operations are, but just in the brute sense of those words, can you give me a sense of the scale that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that is going to be about people finishing, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 head of cattle a year, I should think. You know, that sort of scale it becomes. That would be at the top end. I was chatting to one of the guys who's helping on the hay we were doing the last couple of days, and he's got, they've got 1,000 head at home. And, you know, he's having to work off farm all hours contracting. And so, you know, it just shows there's stresses in that business.
Sure. And what kind of a land base would people typically want to run to support that kind of operation from 1,000 to 5,000?
Well, I guess I could use his example was, I think they had 1,200 acres. They split it and rotated the arable crops, and they were still 600 acres for the cows. That was for 1,000 head, including all the calves and followers on 600 acres. And then they've got arable, and then they'll rotate and bring grass into the rotation and then move the cows onto the grass as the arable rotates around. And of course, if they've got the cows in the sheds over winter, then, you know, they can keep that rotation.
And what have you done on your operation to manage tight margins and some of those things? How have you been able to challenge the paradigms of UK agriculture and ranching?
Well, I guess it's kind of come out of a necessity more than anything. I've always been interested in the environmental side, the ecological side, and so I've always farmed that way and been interested in that. And, you know, in terms of talking about the necessity, it's about keeping the costs really low. You know, those intensive systems are just so capital intensive. We came out of, as I said, I grew up on a 170-acre farm, but we had foot and mouth over here and BSE. We didn't have either of those diseases, but the moves in the markets and family illness at that time as well also meant that we went down to 44 acres and had to sell some land. So trying to build back up from that, you know, we didn't have loads of capital to go and spend it, and we didn't want to borrow a load. So it was just a case of taking on land and, I guess, for 10 years, you know, finding lots of ways to not make any money. And then when the holistic management and mob grazing, that really, and us being able to outwinter, because the costs over here, most of the costs of that suckler cow are, you know, that cow calf are the wintering costs, and you know, especially if they're inside. And so by really looking after our pastures, managing the grazing really carefully and the root structures, deep rooting diverse pastures, it allowed us to hold the cattle up in the fields over winter, something people said we wouldn't be able to do. You know, and neighbours openly telling us that we were going to fail, and when we were taking on farms next door to them, but we just kept going, and then we added it, and I think we did 3 winters on purely on stockpiled forage. So we were just wintered everything out without hay, without anything, and that was, the bank wouldn't lend to us to buy cows to breed from. Because it was, but they'd let us buy stock of cattle, or store cattle as we call them over here, because we'd be turning them over in 12 months. And so we started that way. And, you know, and it was interesting with my dad, who was very conventional, and, you know, that relationship. And actually, when he saw the first lot of cattle go, he could see how little cost there was in them. And when we sold them fat, we hit a peak in the market, and yeah, he could really see the sense in it. And we did that. He's not one to give praise, but I remember he tapped me on the shoulder, looked at the check we received, and just said, "You better go and buy some more." And that's probably the highest praise I've ever had from him. So,
that's the British stiff upper lip, I think. Is that what we call that?
Something like that. I think it's sort of common to all farming families, isn't it? There's not a lot of praise thrown around, is there? So, but we had... yeah, that was good. And we did that. And then I sold the last bunch of store cattle. And then I went and bought, basically, instead of buying more store cattle, I went and bought some pedigree Angus cows. And then I told the bank afterwards. But they, to be fair, we'd been talking to them, and they could see the systems working. And so they supported us. So, it was good.
So you mentioned neighbors outright telling you are going to fail in this experiment of running cattle out all winter. In their mind, what was the biggest challenge facing you in going through the winter out on forage?
Well, it was that we were gonna ruin the pastures. You know, we do. You know, just like you, I think you guys, certain parts of America had quite a wet winter, haven't you? And so, you know, if you get a month, 2 months of solid rain, which can happen here, happen anywhere, then they were, you know, they thought that couldn't work. But I think because we're the kind of the conventional paradigm is that you seed a pasture down to a ryegrass and clover lay. It might last 4, 5, 6 years, and then you'll plough it up and start again and reseed. And so, their experience was, you know, they were right if they were talking about what their own fields looked like and what their soil structure was like. But the fact that they're essentially just, you know, farming one species of grass in there. You know, we're using coxfoot. I think you guys call that orchard grass over there. Deep-rooted grasses like that, tall fescue, and then the deep-rooted herbs. And I think stuff like red fescue as well is really important because it's got real dense root structure as well, which combines with the deep roots, and that I think that really holds the cattle up. And that, you know, the first winter we did it, we did have about 6 weeks. It just rained every day nonstop, and we hadn't done that much on the soils, and yet we still managed it. We did a bit of damage, but you know, the thing you learn is that rest is just a wonderful thing, and it's not something in the conventional system people do, so they don't see the power of it. And that was really, I knew once we got through that winter, if we could do that winter, we could do any winter.
And what were some of the things that enabled you guys to succeed in that? Was it why were your pastures different year one than the neighbor's pastures?
I was lucky. I had the opportunity to take on some land that was already quite diverse, and that they were old pastures, so they hadn't been, well, I say they were old, they'd been seeded down to old pastures. They'd been growing crops about 20 years ago, but then they'd sit for about 15 years, they'd been seeded down to that mixture of grasses and herbs and things, and so I could see that was already an advantage. It had been overgrazed for 15 years, but the right things were there, so I knew we didn't put cattle on until the middle of July, so I let everything grow up. And I think also just having that tall grass grazing where we're probably trampling, some people might say wasted, but we're trampling a fair bit in, but that's also holding the cattle up, so that helped.
Who were some of your influences to start this? I mean, I think you've mentioned as we were recording here that it was out of necessity to survive as a farm and ranch family, but did you have some influences along the way that told you that it might be possible?
Yeah, I mean, we've been started, I suppose it's going back 6-7 years now, we started rotation of grazing, so we were probably always less than 10 days in a pasture. And then I came across Alan Savory's Holistic Management book, and then we started doing that, I think about 6 years ago now. And then the following autumn, there was a holistic management course run over here by a guy called Kurt Gadzia, who used to do a lot of training in the States, came over from New Mexico. And he was really good, just giving you the confidence to go and try it. And we took that land on and it was kind of a shot to nothing in a way. We'd taken a small risk, but ultimately, if it didn't work, it didn't work. So it was also easier that way because it was away from home that, I could kind of do what I wanted rather than have to run everything past the old man. So.
Sure. And you mentioned earlier that you are doing some purebred animals. We'd call that seed stock in the States or raising bulls to sell. Can you talk about the difference between the UK and the US Angus?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If I was to talk about the modern Angus that we have over here, to be honest, there's not a huge amount of difference. You'll see a lot of Chaff Angus Valley, there'll be a lot of Keneally, familiar prefixes used over here, and certainly the higher growth end, certainly the Scottish cattle, or the Scottish breeders rather, are very much down that high-end growth route. But we also have, as part of the herd book, is a register of all the native Angus cattle that have never had any North American bloodlines imported. So they're a much smaller framed animal, and I find them just lower maintenance requirements on them. And I think you have to find the right lines, but they work, keep our costs down. We don't want our cows to cost us. They've got to work for us. And so, yeah, but I don't think we want to throw out the window some of the improvements that modern Angus have made in terms of forage conversion and that side of things. And so I think the blend works really well, actually. You've just got to keep selecting the right cattle in and the right cattle out.
How long have you been doing it?
We've been in the pedigree Angus here about four years now, so we've bought our first cattle. But in terms of breeding cattle long term, we've always been in pedigree cattle for a long time. Dad and granddad used to breed pedigree Herefords. Dad exported bulls. I think he exported a bull to China, and so we've always been in pedigree livestock, and just having a brief break when things weren't going as well, and that's been a great help actually. Going and buying cattle, they were trying to breed bigger cattle, but they were always sticklers on structure. So the feet aren't right, if the legs aren't right, if they haven't got an udder that's going to last, they're just zero tolerance, and that's really helped us, I think, in quite a short space of time in buying the right cows in and starting that. And you know, there's always a challenge because I think the modern Angus is such a diverse gene pool that you know, how true they actually breed, you still got to do a lot of selecting out. But over time and just starting to use our own bulls more now, we're hoping to concentrate, you know, what works here. And I think actually the way the industry's going, you know, the projections are not good for beef prices the next 10 years globally. And I think the lower cost animal is the only way forward if you look at what's happened in New Zealand and elsewhere. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And who are you saying was a stickler on the phenotype or the animal itself and their structure?
Yeah, that'd be my father and grandfather. They're absolute sticklers on leg structure, foot structure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just something I think that's really started to come into the mainstream in the States is paying attention to the foot structure. And I saw one of the first articles I've ever read not too long ago on foot condition scoring and kind of paying attention to those animals and those things like that. So I suppose in a wetter environment, it's probably even more important.
Yeah, you know, too much hoof growth and just gets away in soft ground, absolutely. So it's got to be right. And the thing is, that's, you can look at all the EBVs and you can look at all that side of things, but ultimately your best test is if she brings a calf every year and she's still in the herd, then her udder and her feet and her legs are probably right. And, you know, if she's reached a ripe old age, so that there's, you can keep it fairly simple as well. You can complicate it too.
Yeah, yeah, I really do agree with that way of thinking. Who am I to tell her that she's not right if she's continuing to bring a calf in every year? So, yeah, definitely. In my understanding of Europe and the UK, there's quite a bit more demand for all natural or organic. Is that an accurate understanding?
I'd say probably not, actually. I think people... it's probably the same everywhere, but as soon as they step in the supermarket, they're buying on one thing as a rule, which is price. I think there's a growing understanding, a growing movement of understanding for grass-fed beef, but it's not grown as fast as it has in the States.
Hmm.
We were quite early into the Pasture-Fed Livestock Association, which is a group of farmers over here promoting grass-fed beef and grass-fed production. Great organisation, farmer-led, and that is growing quite well now, and it's getting some political traction now where politicians are looking to try and pick a system that stands up. So the animal welfare side of things, we're getting a lot of heat from the vegans and all that sort of stuff at the moment. I'm cautiously optimistic. We don't want to encourage them too much, but I think... You know, there's a lot of ex-vegans out there who buy sustainable meat now, and I wonder if that might help us in the long run.
And I don't know how well this illustration will connect, but there's a lot of people who voted for President Trump that also voted for President Obama. It's kind of the new hot thing, and they tend to be a little bit like a windsock, going whichever way the wind blows. So I think that might be maybe contributing factor.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, as long as it looks good on Instagram, I think they're happy, aren't they?
Does it get likes? Does it get likes? That's the question. Yeah. So what about the state of regenerative agriculture and what work is being done, what work remains to be done, what ground has been taken, I guess, so to speak?
It's really growing. I think it's just reaching a tipping point now. Over here where it's absolutely it's becoming part of the mainstream conversation. So we were very lucky to have a double page done in the Farmers Weekly magazine, which over here would be considered kind of the industry, machinery dealers, you know, chemical sales, all the advertisers pay for the content. So the fact that they were even looking at us or interested, you know, and we're not the only ones. There's a lot of other folks as well, some really good people in over here doing a lot of good. And I think, you know, and ultimately with the internet and, you know, podcasts like yours, you know, there's a lot of folks over here listen to your podcast. You're probably able to see the figures of how much, you know, but the people in Region Ag over here, they're talking about your podcast, they're talking about this information. So there's not a gatekeeper on this information of who's doing well with a new system anymore. It's not all just put more on. There's other ways of looking at it, and I think...
Unless you're talking about put more animals on, right?
Absolutely, yeah. But there's a really good conference that started. One of the co-members, another member of the Pasture Fed Livestock Association, just started a conference on his farm called Groundswell. Alan Savory just came to speak at it. Greg Judy came last year. And it's just taken off, and we're a small country. So to get, I'm guessing, like 1,000 farmers plus going to this thing, it's really great. And John Cherry and the Cherry family who set that up deserve a huge amount of credit, because it's a fabulous thing. And that's getting coverage in the farming press. People are talking about it on the radio. And, that's only going to move it in one direction. And I think, we're at a stage where we need there to be good stories about agriculture. And I think regenerative agriculture offers that in spades all the time. There's always a good story there.
Yeah, lots of cards stacked against agriculture as a whole, and being able to tell a unique story that isn't being told is an important part of being able to sustain the demand for our products, and I think that there is, as you said, those forces allied against agriculture, and regenerative agriculture seems to be providing the most palatable answer, and I guess in my estimation the best answers, but I have some biases probably that lead me in that direction.
yeah, I think that's right, and I think it's interesting, just in terms of plant physiology on the grasses, like with the way the research is done, that we're told that, we should regraze that growing plant before it's got its energy stores back in the plant. And what that does is it massively reduces the regrowth. So what you're going to need inputs to make that plant grow. So, it just does make you suspicious about why we're advised to do that. And maybe they're right. Maybe when it was a production paradigm where we're getting paid on production, and there's a shortage of food, maybe that's the right thing. But I think we're in a different situation now where there's potentially an oversupply of food. And even in the long term, it looks that way. So, there's a different situation at hand.
You mean globally there's an oversupply of food?
Yeah, on average. And I think I don't know how much notice we should pay to it, but the latest UN report on what the food prices are going to be over the next 10 years are either static or downwards. And I think, we're in that, that tells me we need a low-cost cow. So.
Right. Yep. I agree wholeheartedly. And I think that people who have been willing to question the official narrative for a long time have recognized that generally the problem with people who are starving is not a lack of available food. It's a lack of distribution channels in them, and honestly, a lot of times there's a warlord or a government in between the producer and those end consumers in those impoverished countries who is shutting off that flow of nutrition to them. And so it isn't necessarily that we need to produce more, it's that we need to figure out ways to go around those people who are standing in the way and get food to them, as I understand it anyways.
Yeah, no, I think 100%, that's it. And I think we've got enough. We can feed the world. I think it's interesting, though, if a lot of the research that we've had has been about production, and if we're not, and that's really important. I don't want to downplay that. But if we look at the cattle side of it, that's what business we're in, where, the EBVs or the EPDs, they're all based, like the growth EPDs, they're all based on growth. It's not necessarily based on the profit for the cow-calf producer or the suckler cow producer. And if we're selecting for growth, what are we selecting for? Are we selecting for more milk? Are we selecting for, a hormone balance that's geared towards growth rather than fertility? There's a lot of antagonistic traits that we might not have been paying attention to. And what excites me in the industry now is that the scientists are starting to get quite interested in what we're doing in regenerative agriculture, and farmers and ranchers are leading this and they're kind of following. But, you know, if we've had 60 years of research into production agriculture at all costs, then what's the next 60 years look like if we've got scientists helping us and working with us to take these kinds of systems forward as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate that perspective. What's next? What are you working on right now in your ranch business?
We've just took on another farm 2 years ago, and then 35 acres just popped up about 6 weeks ago nearby. So we've just taken that on, and I think we're just gonna. I don't want to say stagnate, but we want to stand still for a little bit. I think I think the cows are getting better, and I want to concentrate on that for a few years, and just build a little bit of, make sure all the foundations are in place for when the next opportunity comes along, that we're not stretching ourselves. I had this spring, someone came to me with another 450 acres, which would have doubled our size, and very nearly bit the hand off. But actually, it was just, look, we're possibly growing, stretching ourselves too much. And I think holistic management framework as well helps, because, yeah, I probably would have loved to take it on, take on the challenge, take on the work. But, you know, I've also got a wife and three kids who I might want to see sometimes. And actually, you know, building the business to a point where we've got some staff to support us and help us with the expansion in the future, and make sure we don't put the business at risk because we're trying to grow too quick. So we're going to sort of a bit of stasis, a bit of promotion of what we're doing with the cattle, and build that firm foundation where we've got a secure customer base to grow from, really.
Sure. And your end customer is that purchaser of a seed stock animal, or are there other products that you're marketing?
Mainly the seed stock. And that's selling to commercial folks. You know, a lot of our suckler cow herd is based off a big dairy Holstein cross with a Continental, a Charolais, or a Limousin, or something like that, or a Belgian Blue. And you know, the cow herds are high maintenance, so they're expensive to keep. And I think more and more people are coming over to the smaller frame cow over here, just as they have in the States. And so they'll use our bulls to reduce that frame size and produce some good females for them, and then maybe put a terminal bull on the cows they're not going to keep females from.
Yep, that's I think a pretty popular model in this part of the world as well. So very, very cool to see these similarities, and you know, as I like to say, has been said many times, it works everywhere it's tried, and you are further proof of that.
Well, yeah, it's got to work, otherwise it doesn't happen next year, does it?
right. Yep. Very good. So I want to wrap up with this question. Other than giving you an opportunity to promote anything that you want to promote, when I asked you what people thought was going to be the biggest challenge to running the cow herd out on grass for the winter, and you gave me your response of, you know, ruining the pastures or, you know, the mud, dealing with the mud. What actually turned out to be the biggest challenge for you in running them out through the winter?
I'd be lying if I didn't say that wasn't a challenge in that first year before we got the soil 100% where we wanted it. But we did manage it just through quicker moves, moving twice a day, giving them more area and all that sort of stuff. I think part of it as well is, I mean, really, it couldn't have gone better, you know. So I think we were lucky. But I think also it was just, it was testament to the system that had worked. I had confidence in Kirk and what he'd given to us and told us we ought to be able to do on our rainfall and our soil types. So we were able to take that forward. I think from the other perspective of other farmers, perhaps, noticing, you know, we've had a lot of open days. I've got guys who've come to open days for the last 5 years, and they're still coming, but they still haven't started. And I sort of I take that, maybe that's a bit of a failure of the trainer, I don't know. But I think it's interesting. Just sometimes you've just got to do what some people might call a half-assed job and then learn from it, rather than just trying to get everything perfect before you start. And, you know, you just got to do it because it's the best way to learn. And we certainly learned a lot that first year.
I have no idea who originally said it, but there's a saying that's become popular that is, perfect is the enemy of done.
Yeah, 100%. And I wouldn't say that there's a lot perfect done here, but there's plenty done.
So I noticed one time on Facebook a advertisement for a conference that you'll be speaking at. Is that's still coming up, still in the future?
Yeah, we've got there's an open day on the farm. We've got on the 30th of July, but that's just sold. We're just fully booked. We had to book a bigger venue for that, so we've got about 80 folks coming to that. So really pleased with that. And then we've got I'm speaking at a conference in Ireland on the 7th. I think it's the 6th and 7th of November, and that looks like a really good session. Some really great speakers. And already the organisers seem to be talking more about the beer than the content of the conference, so I think it'd be a good time as well.
Yeah, there's a, what is it, God invented whiskey to keep Irish from ruling the world, I think, or something like that. So
I like that, yeah.
Connery, my last name is an Irish last name, so I have a fair bit of understanding of how that can be true. So,
yeah.
Anything else you want to share? Anything else you want to promote? Links you want to share or resources that have been helpful to you that you would like to make people aware of?
Well, I think in the UK, I would just say the Pasture Fed Livestock Association has been a great help to me, mainly because of the other farmers in it. So that, you know, we're all kind of learning together, and the willingness of people to share is fantastic. But there's also some great Facebook groups. I think you're on as well, Clay, like the regenerative agriculture, regenerative grazing, holistic management ones. And again, people just sharing loads of really good stuff. Every problem that you might ask a question, and there might be three people telling you you're doing it wrong, but there's going to be someone giving you the perfect answer on there as well. And it's great, you know, that people are sharing and giving you that information. I'd also say, I mean, one of the reasons I contacted you in the first place was just a little note, because you just brought a focus back in that one podcast. I forget the name of it, about bringing it back to your faith and to relying on Christ in our lives and that sort of things. And I think something I think I said to you was that I probably don't do that enough, but I've probably heard it at the right time. And I think, for me, it was the right time to hear that. But I think it's interesting with regenerative agriculture, and when people talk about the buffalo on the plains and all this sort of stuff, that actually, like, we haven't beaten the productivity of creation yet. And maybe if we were been given a blueprint, it's probably not a bad idea to follow it. And so I guess that might be the message that comes at the end.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree totally. And I think that when we talk about working with nature in regenerative agriculture, we're just following the blueprint. And when you have a blueprint, that means you have an architect. And I think we've got an architect that has given us a blueprint in the person of God the Father. And he's sent his son Jesus to rescue us from our failures, not only our failures in regenerative agriculture, but also our failures in how we manage our relationships regeneratively and all those things. So I think we're just following the blueprint, and I think that working with nature is just paying attention to God's design of nature and how it can care for itself if we partner with him in stewarding it well.
Yeah, 100%. And it's not just in agriculture, is it? But when we stop listening, that's when we tend to go wrong, isn't it?
So. Right. Yep. Yeah, very much. Well, Bob, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to continuing to connect with you. And if you've ever got something that you want to promote to anybody, let me know, and I'd be happy to host you for another episode and give you an opportunity to share it with people who'd be interested.
Great. Thanks, Clay. Really appreciate it. Love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Fantastic.
As I said, thank you again to the Old Crow Corner in Kildare, North Dakota. Please, if you're traveling through, stop in. It's right on the southern edge of the Badlands and some beautiful country. Worth the trip, worth the stop, and very, very much appreciate their hospitality today. And so coming up next, I don't know when, but coming up next, I'm really excited to talk to Morgan Hartman of Black Queen Angus in upstate New York, and he's going to talk through planning our land and planning our grazing and holistic planned grazing and where to start and how to get started. And that was a user suggested or a listener suggested guest and a listener suggested topic. So we're going to kill two birds with one stone here with Morgan as soon as I can get it released episode 99 of the Working Cows podcast. And also we will be having episode 100 with a special surprise guest. I've given some hints along the way over the months since I started kind of teasing it out, and maybe some of you know who it is. I've talked to some of you about the episode already, but really excited about this guest, and hopefully if we can get Morgan's episode out for episode 99, we can also get this episode out with this surprise guest yet this week for episode 100 of the Working Cows podcast. So stay tuned for that. And also check out the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/98. And we'll see you again. We'll see you again as soon as possible with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.